I have to write a note.
I apologize, Your Honor. I'm not sure I heard you there. A brave new world indeed.
May I suggest we take a break then if the...
I can hear you now.
You can hear me? Okay.
I can hear you now.
All right.
Did you like my...
Yeah, exactly. Let us know if you need us to send someone to help you. If you did have, you know.
Jerome is doing a great job. Thank you, Jerome.
Unless Your Honor is really just in code saying, I really need a break.
Right.
All right. Good morning. We're here on the last case, Amy Dunn versus Global Trust Management. Counsel for the appellants, are you ready to proceed?
I am, Your Honor. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. May it please the court. My name is Clifford Burlow, and I'm here on behalf of the defendants in this case, Global Trust Management, and Frank Torres, who is one of the company's executives. This case arises under the Federal Arbitration Act. And under the Federal Arbitration Act, the immediate question before the court, the threshold issue for Your Honors, is not whether this agreement as a whole is enforceable or not. It is who decides whether this agreement as a whole is enforceable or not. That is because these arbitration agreements include a delegation clause that clearly and expressly assign the responsibility for resolving disputes regarding validity and enforceability to an arbitrator. So all of the discussion in the district court's opinion, as well as in the plaintiff's brief, that focus on the interest rates, that focus on the agreement as a whole, that focus on the choice of law provision, all of those put the cart before the horse. Under the Supreme Court's controlling precedent in this area, Rent-A-Center against Jackson and the Henry Schein case from 2018, a delegation clause of this sort is to be upheld except for in the rarest of circumstances. And we would submit that the plaintiffs have not carried their burden, and make no mistake, it is the plaintiff's burden to establish that these delegation clauses are unenforceable. The reason we say that is that in order to demonstrate that a delegation clause is unenforceable, the defect, the flaw, has to be with the delegation itself, not the agreements that are going to be applied ultimately and reviewed by the arbitrator. If you look broadly at the precedent in this area, there are really only two circumstances that seem to arise in which the problem is with the delegation clause itself. The first is where there's a defect in the arbitral forum, where the forum either is non-existent or there is some reason to think it's effectively a kangaroo court. That's not the argument here. The plaintiffs have not argued that a JAMS or AAA arbitrator is little more than a shill. The second category is where I think we
is that who the mediating company is? The mediator is JAMS?
That's correct. JAMS or AAA, okay. And there's a choice between the two of them. And they both obviously have their own rules and they will then.
And may I ask you a question? My understanding is that the applicable arbitration agreement at issue here is the 2017, because there's language in the agreement says that it could the terms can change.
That's correct, Your Honor, with respect to Plaintiff Dunn. With respect to Plaintiff McIntosh, it's the 2016 terms. And so there may be a slight difference between the terms. Ultimately, we don't think that really matters.
But both of them have language that say federal law also applies.
No, that is the distinction here. So the
2017 has it.
The 2017 has it expressed. I think the way to think about it is that the 2017 agreement makes explicit what is really only implicit in the 2016. The 2016 terms say that the arbitration will be conducted in accordance with the Federal Arbitration Act. The Federal Arbitration Act, in turn, incorporates all of the traditional contract defenses to enforceability. So you get there a little bit more circuitously. The 2017 agreement on its face says all of federal law. And that's before you start accounting to what tribal law here actually is. But again, taking a step back, where courts have seemed to get tripped up with these delegation clause disputes, at least when you look at the cases that the plaintiffs have cited here, is on this question, not of where there's not a defect on with an arbital form, that seems rather obvious. It's the second category where the question really is whether the challenge to the enforceability of the agreement, whether the outcome is preordained because of the terms of the arbitration agreement. And here, I would commend to your honors the recent decision from the Ninth Circuit in the Bryce decision. The court there goes through and I think rightly explains what the standard is here. The standard is to ask the question about whether or not when you agreed the terms of the delegation clause, as well as other provisions in the agreement, whether or not there is no reasonable argument here that the enforceability challenge that the plaintiffs would like to assert could be brought before the arbitrator. If it can be brought, if the law is available, that's sufficient to satisfy the requirements under Schein and under Rent-A-Center for the enforcement of the delegation clause. And so in that respect, this is a straightforward case.
Let me ask you to address a hypothetical that, and I'm not saying that's this case, but I mean, let's say you had an arbitration agreement and the choice of law provision was the law of Mars, right? It just, or there is no law. Law of personal combat, right?
The good old days.
Yeah, right, exactly. Yeah, choose your weapon. So would that be, and someone said, look, you can't make me go to an arbitrator to dispute the arbitrability of this under this delegation clause. The only law to apply is force of arms. Like that, you just can't enforce this delegation clause. Do you view that in a rubric as a challenge to the delegation clause itself? And would that challenge make sense? Or would that be something that we would in fact have to enforce, go to the arbitrator and make that in front of the arbitrator whose choice of law is force of arms?
Judge Brasher, I actually think that is a circumstance where the issue would be one for the court. That's a challenge to the delegation clause. And here's why that's distinct from this case. Presumably, the law of combat or the law of Mars wouldn't have available the ability to mount a validity or enforceability challenge as a matter of contract law. So the opportunity there would be stripped by the terms of the agreement. And it would be stripped, obviously and plainly, beyond any dispute. Remember that in this area of law, the Supreme Court has set out a special rule of construction, going all the way back to Moses H. Cohn, that you see running all through these decisions, including Rent-A-Center, Concepcion, all the way up through Henry Schein, which is all ambiguities, all close questions, all nuances should be construed by a court for purposes of the Federal Arbitration Act in favor of arbitrability. So to put it, I think, a little bit more simply to answer your question, Your Honor, the standard that the plaintiffs have to satisfy here is a high one. What the plaintiffs have to show here is, after construing every provision in the agreement that's even marginally ambiguous in favor of arbitration, they have to show that it would be unconscionable to have an arbitrator decide whether this agreement is unconscionable. And to put it another way, and to go one step further, their burden here is to show that, again, construing everything in favor of arbitration, that it would be unconscionable to have a retired judge from JAMS decide whether or not this agreement is unconscionable. I would submit that they haven't carried that very, very high burden. The court in Henry Schein made very clear that a delegation, as well, and I think probably Rent-A-Center to a greater degree, a delegation clause is an antecedent, standalone, separate agreement that exists within the terms of an arbitration agreement. And what you can't do is what the plaintiffs are trying to do here and what I would submit the district court did here, which is effectively leapfrog the question about whether there's a problem with the delegation itself in order to attack the remainder of the agreement. That's the very problem that we see in this line of cases. And I would absolutely acknowledge that there is something of a split of authority on these issues, Your Honor. There is the Bryce case in the Ninth Circuit, and then the Second, Third, and Fourth Circuits on the other hand. I would submit that the degree to which there's a split is somewhat debatable, but yes.
Counsel, may I ask you a question, though? But it at least from my perspective, it appears to me that the dispute is really that in the cases in the Second and the Third and the Fourth, there wasn't specific language that allowed for federal rights to be enforced. It didn't have a discussion regarding, and that's why I asked that question regarding the language in the agreement.
So I would agree, Your Honor, that this agreement is unlike any that any of the federal courts of appeals have looked at in that respect, particularly the 2017 agreement. Again, 2016, I think it's pretty well implicit, but that's a distinction that exists with the 2017 agreement. I would also come back, though, to the point that there is something of a split on these questions. I think it's a little bit ambiguous as to whether it's a split over how to read one particular contract or whether it's a true methodological split over what the standard is. I do think that Judge Forrest's decision for the Ninth Circuit gets this absolutely right, which is to say, you look at the terms and the critical question is there any reasonable argument to be made that an arbitrator can resolve this enforceability challenge? In that case, it was a prospective waiver doctrine, which deals with federal law. In this case, the plaintiffs, I think, are effectively arguing that the prospective waiver doctrine should be extended to state statutes. There are all sorts of problems with that.
Can you talk about that? I know your time is up, but I'll let you have additional time because I'm interested in their argument that one of the problems is that it doesn't allow them to proceed with their state claim.
Certainly, Your Honor.
Under FEDACTA.
Certainly. Yes. To be clear, you only reach that question if you get beyond the delegation clause point. So for present purposes, I'm going to put aside what I think is the only question before the court. But if you find that they've challenged it and they've met their very high showing, then you would reach this question about whether or not the agreement as a whole is enforceable. I would submit to Your Honor that, one, they're applying the wrong test. They want to apply the general test for unconscionability rather than the test that's used to evaluate whether a choice of law provision is enforceable. The choice of law provision test has to do with public policy and its significance to the overall state regime. The Florida courts, I imagine as you well know, have said that the usury statutes in Florida are not the strong public policy of the state. So we think that their argument founders there just simply because you never really reach the issue that you're referring to. The second point is that the idea that you're extending the prospective waiver doctrine to cover state claims, which again, I think you only really reach if you're in sort of a general unconscionability analysis. That argument is problematic simply because the Supreme Court has been very clear that the prospective waiver doctrine is about federal law, and particularly in this context where you're talking about a tribal entity, the notion that it would be unconscionable for a tribe to say it's not subject to state law when its businesses generally are not subject to state law seems a little bit strange. And I'm not relying on the uniqueness of a tribal business necessarily, but I think that the bottom line is if you extend the doctrine that way, businesses across all sorts of, across the spectrum, Rent-A-Center was an employment contract, Henry Schein was medical supplies, they're going to have a very difficult time having any kind of choice of law provision that would ever be effectuated in their arbitration agreements because they can't waive federal law and they can't waive state law. So what's the point of having a choice of law provision? And that's going to apply writ large, not just in the lending context, but across businesses.
Thank you, counsel. You have time remaining for rebuttal. Thank you very much for your argument.
Good morning. Ken Reamer for the appellees. May it please the court. So the central component of this arbitration agreement, and really the central issue below and the central issue here, is the absolute ban on state law. And the difference between, there really is no substantive difference between the 2015/2016 version and 2017. The only actual difference is the 2017 version defines as exclusive applicable law, tribal law, and applicable federal law. Whereas the 2015-2016 version, which applies Ms. McIntosh's case, have an outright ban on the application of any law from any state of the United States. But they both, either by exclusion or by specific edict, prohibit the application of any state law. And that is why it's problematic for purposes of the delegation clause, purposes of Florida law, purposes of the FAA and its savings clause. But before we get into that, I think it's important to know why this is. So the loans that were purchased by the defendant here, defendant is not the tribe, defendant is a debt collector, assignee of these loans, embody a model, a business model, internet, very high interest, small payday loans that depend on the violation of state laws like Florida's, which specifically target these types of loans. This business model cannot exist with the application of any state law. Now, this is not, as my colleague infers, a case where you're choosing between two legal regimes. This appeal is unique in this aspect. It addresses a situation that completely throws out all state law regimes, and that includes all state law rules regarding contract defenses, the enforceability of choices of law, formation issues, everything that a district that an arbitrator or a district court needs to have at its disposal to render a decision about arbitrability, and then enforceability of the arbitration clause, and then validity of the contract as a whole. And the district court correctly held that by stripping an arbitrator of the state law regime, of any state law tools to do this, it's unworkable. And it's also important to understand the mechanism that this ban of state law exists in. So we have an arbitration agreement that is the scope of which is as broad as you can possibly write an arbitration scope clause. It includes everything, and it specifically includes state law claims. At the same time, it ensures that an arbitrator does not have the tools or not have the ability to adjudicate those claims without violating the very terms of that agreement. So this is problematic, really, for three reasons. On the delegation clause, as I've said, it clashes with the core principles of FAA. Counsel's correct. One of those principles is a liberal policy in favor of arbitration, and all inferences should be resolved in favor of arbitration. Arbitration clauses shall not be treated in any inferior way to other clauses, other contract provisions. But at the same time, you have the savings clause, which ensures the interjection of state interest, state law, into the whole analysis. And the whole point of the Concepcion, well, going back to First Options, Perry Thomas, and then going all the way through the Concepcion class waiver cases, is this distinction between state laws that do either directly or implicitly put arbitration clauses in an inferior position, and state laws which are neutral about arbitration, but which inform contract enforcement. And getting to the prospective waiver issue, it's not that we're asking for an extension of the prospective waiver doctrine. What we're pointing out is that Florida has its own prospective waiver doctrine, and that's the Romero case and the line of cases following that, which say that. Under Florida law, you cannot enforce any provision in a contract, arbitration or otherwise, that prohibits the vindication of a state remedial statutory claim, which we have in this case. Our clients bring claims under the state version of the Federal Fair Debt Collection Practices Act that depends on. It is a state law, and it's premised on the violation of the state usury statutes. We're also not asking for an extension because, as a practical effect, the removal of state law, the ban on arbitrator applying state law, for all practical purposes and in a real way prevents the adjudication of our client's FDCPA claim, our federal claims. And this is why it's difficult to sort of make this clean distinction between what the prospective waiver doctrine prohibits, state versus federal cases, because there are federal statutes, and the FDCPA is a great example of one, that interlace state law principles in their prohibitive provisions. So the FDCPA prohibits the collection of any invalid debt, including debt that's rendered invalid by state law. So here you have an arbitrator. The arbitration clause does say you get to apply applicable federal law, but the claim itself depends on us proving that the contract violates state law. So the arbitrator pulls out the agreement and says, oh, wait a minute, I can't apply any state law in this case at all. The lender nor the contract is subject to any state law. So the claim cannot be adjudicated, not fairly, at least.
What do you say about it? Here's I guess my issue about the delegation clause. I read the district court's order on sort of the overall enforceability of the arbitration agreement, and I'm looking in there for something that an arbitrator, him or herself, couldn't say, right? And so I'm trying to figure out, I guess, you know, kind of answer this for me. I mean, is there anything in the district court's order that you couldn't get from an arbitrator, right? That the arbitrator could say the same thing the district court did, and then you'd win in front of the arbitrator on delegation.
Yes, because there's a step that is necessary in evaluating enforceability that the arbitration clause itself prohibits because it bans state law, and the step is deciding whether the choice of law selected by the parties is valid in the first place. Sure. Parties can choose law, and the choice is presumptively enforcement, but it's not absolute. State law provides defenses to the enforcement of a clause. In your example, if the party selected the law of Mars or the law of personal combat, in any state, and even under in a federal question case here, under the application of the restatement, an entity can say, well, we did sign that agreement, but it's not enforceable because it violates policy, public policy of the state that would otherwise be, whose law would otherwise apply. And that's the analysis that the court went through that an arbitrator couldn't go through.
Maybe I'm dense, but no. I don't understand why that is. Why can't the arbitrator go through that analysis that the court would go through?
Because the savings clause ensures that an arbitrator have access to laws to grounds as exist in law and equity that would apply to any other contract. That's a key component to the FAA structure. So this clause removes that because this court, when the Supreme Court in the first option cases and the cases that came after that, and this court in the Bazemore case and others, made clear that the savings clause requires application of state law. And it is articulated by the Supreme Court as a substantive mandate for the application of state law principles. And this makes sense. A state like Florida has a legitimate interest in regulating commerce in its borders and protecting its consumers. We know that. The way its interest is manifested in an arbitration clause or any other states is the savings clause. The savings clause prohibits an arbitration clause to shut out state court interest or state interest.
Counsel, don't we do that all the time in the state of Florida? Let's say with respect to cruise ship in state court, where we would get an appeal saying, we can't litigate our state claims in state court, that we can only litigate in federal court.
Well, I think you have to distinguish between the procedural or the formation issues, so the delegation issues, like is it enforceable, and then what kinds of claims are articulated. And in those, the cruise ship cases, there are a lot of admiralty cases where you have clauses that incorporate the laws of Germany or whatever. But the decisions are weighing the home regime, legal regime, versus another regime that exists, and a lot of those cases talk about, well, there's applicable principles of law over here, so it's not completely shut out. Here, it shuts out everything, and it directly an absolute ban on state law directly clashes with the plain language of the FAA, grounds as exist, not grounds.
But what if your client had opted out of the arbitration agreement because the forum allows for a written opt-out, does it not?
Well, and this is probably one of the worst aspects of the clause, because the opt-out, the whole idea of an opt-out is supposed to allow a plaintiff or litigant to opt out of an arbitration regime because it's unfair and into something that provides more protection, or at least equal protection. This opt-out does nothing. First of all, it does nothing to the ban on state law, which is unique here. And it just shifts the venue to the tribal court. And as I read the opt-out, it even eliminates the applicable federal law component, because at least some of the versions of this complaint say that if you do opt out and you end up in the tribal court, then you only are subject to tribal law. But even if you take applicable law, if applicable federal law, and you applied it to this opt-out, you don't change the fundamental unfairness of and the fundamental unworkability of the clause, because you don't add the grounds as exist in law and equity that would apply to any other contract, as required by the savings clause. So it doesn't save anything. It in fact puts her out of the pot and into the frying pan, because it still prevents her from bringing her state and federal claims, and even more so because she doesn't even have applicable federal law, and it changes the venue, the forum only. And we add in our brief that the opt-out places the plaintiffs before a court that has that doesn't have subject matter jurisdiction. And this is discussed in some of the tribal cases, I believe Jackson and some of the others in the other circuits, that tribal court jurisdiction is focused on transactions that concern the reservation and members, and it's highly questionable that the tribal court would have any subject matter jurisdiction in an opt-out situation, and you cannot waive or create subject matter jurisdiction by agreement. Just to address briefly the state law under Romero, and Romero is a lower court decision or a DCA decision, but its principle was adopted by the Florida Supreme Court in the Schatz case that strictly prohibits any contract provision that bans the adjudication of remedial rights. The reason that that's important, because it not only represents the state perspective, a waiver doctrine, but it also, we have this debate in below and in the briefings about whether the strong policy test applies under state law with respect to the enforceability of the conflict of law or the choice of law clause, or this fundamental policy test that the court applied because it sat in federal question jurisdiction and applied the restatement. But it doesn't matter, because you get to the same result either way. Both doctrines, restatement and the strong policy doctrine, both allow a choice of law clause to be circumvented when it violates important state policy, whether you call it fundamental or strong. And there is no doubt that the Romero rule is a strong policy articulated by the courts of Florida that say, no matter what, you cannot agree to extinguish remedial consumer rights. If the legislator takes the time and effort to articulate remedial consumer protections, you can't contract those away. I see I'm out of time. Thank you. If there's no other questions, I'll rest. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel, very much for your argument. Mr. Berlow, you have 5 minutes remaining for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I want to begin, Judge Brasher, with the question that you presented, which is there anything in the district court's decision that an arbitrator could not say? The answer my colleague here gave today was yes, and he says that's because there's an out-and-out ban under these agreements on the application of all state law. That's wrong, and it's wrong for really two reasons. The first is that there is not an out-and-out ban on all state law. We've talked about it in our brief, that the tribal law that applies here has incorporated Louisiana state contract law into the tribal law. And that gives you at least an avenue to make your contractual argument. The second point along those lines is that the question is not whether or not it incorporates state or federal law. The question is whether it allows for the recognition of defenses to challenges to the enforceability or validity of the contract. The problem here is you need to look a little bit at what the plaintiffs are doing. They are trying to take the most unfavorable reading they possibly can to their own interests from this agreement, and then saying, well, there's no way that we can mount an effective enforceability or validity challenge. That gets it 100% backwards, and the plaintiff basically acknowledged as much. Again, there is a special rule of construction. All doubts are resolved in favor of arbitration, not against. This idea that what the plaintiffs ought to do is try and find a way to blow up the entire agreement by essentially saying that every single thing in it is likely to be or must definitely be resolved against their interest by an arbitrator simply gets it wrong. I'd point out, in the plaintiff's brief, you'd think there had never been a decision from the Supreme Court regarding delegation clauses. It cites Jackson, the Renner Center against Jackson, only once, only in a general quote about what delegation clauses are, and it ignores entirely the Henry Schein decision. I would commend those cases to your honors. I think if you look at those, it makes the practice and policy from the Supreme Court about how the Arbitration Act is supposed to apply perfectly clear. And if I can just take a step back and give you what I think is the big picture perspective on this. The threshold question, and it's always for a court, we absolutely believe this, is whether there is a contract between the two parties. That means, has there been offer? Has there been acceptance? And that's usually where the debate is. Has there been consideration? After that, you get to step two. Step two is to ask the question about whether or not the agreement includes a delegation clause. If it does not, then it's for the court to resolve any challenge to enforceability. If there is a delegation clause, then the question is, again, construing every part of the agreement in favor of there being an arbitration on the enforceability question, whether or not the terms of the agreement as a whole make it a preordained outcome, a fait accompli, that no arbitrator could plausibly ever rule that the agreement is invalid. I would submit to you that the Ninth Circuit gets this right. There is nothing on the face of a delegation clause like this, which is, I think, functionally the same as what they were looking at there, that would say, no, a plaintiff could never win on that issue. The plaintiffs are sliding, I think you heard it here today, they slide back and forth between talking about delegation clause and talking about the agreement as a whole. That's improper. That's improper under the Supreme Court's precedent in this area, and it's improper because of what the Supreme Court has said, that is what Congress has dictated in the Federal Arbitration Act for how this analysis to proceed. And no matter how many policy arguments the plaintiffs want to advance about this industry, about the fairness of any of these agreements, none of that undoes the policy judgment that Congress made, which is that arbitration agreements like this should be affirmed by the courts. Judge Legault, I want to take just a moment to address the questions that you presented to my colleague here.
I asked you one question before yes. before you ask me that. I want to confirm, because I was looking at the complaints filed by Ms. Dunn, and there isn't any allegation in there that there is no valid contract, from what I could see.
That's correct, Your Honor, and the district court found that there was an agreement, and the plaintiffs didn't challenge that on appeal. So I would assume that we can safely say that the question of whether there's a contract, that threshold issue for the court, has been definitively resolved. I have just a few seconds left, but Judge Lagoa, you asked the question about the opt-out clause and whether or not that alters or impacts the unconscionability analysis. I would submit to Your Honor, again, we probably never reached that issue, but as a matter of procedural unconscionability, we believe that that is sufficient to make sure that this agreement is not found procedurally unconscionable. Notice what the plaintiff's assumption here is. Because it's a tribal court, it is necessarily bad. It's necessarily unfair. Unlike the decisions that have found procedural unconscionability where an opt-out leads to a tribal court, they haven't provided any specific argument, evidence, discussion about the tribal court. There is amicus support here that talks about the law of the Tunica Biloxi tribe and their courts. I would think if you look at it, it will comport with every notion you would have of fairness and due process. And the last,
what about the in the record, from my understanding, is that they want us to take judicial notice of the fact that the tribe's rules of civil procedure were not available to them.
So, Judge Legault, the answer to that question is twofold. First, they're wrong when they say that. It's just not true. Any single person could have gone to the clerk's office at the Tunica Biloxi and said, I would like a copy of the Code of Civil Procedure, please, and they could have had it. This is not a secret law. This is not the sort of Gestapo tactics that the plaintiffs, I think, dramatically want to suggest went on here. The second point is, though, yes, they were not available on the internet when they entered into the agreement, and that has nothing to do with whether they are bound by the tribal law. What was incorporated by reference into this agreement is tribal law as a whole, and that includes the Code of Civil Procedure, whether they could Google it or not. And then the last point is, Judge Legault, you made the point, I think, correctly, that when it comes to choice of law clauses, when it comes to upholding them, Florida courts regularly uphold choice of law provisions that circumvent or bypass certain Florida statutes. There's nothing unusual about that. There's nothing wrong with that. And I would commend to the court the portion of our brief where we discuss Florida law on this point. We cited no fewer than a dozen cases, all of which say it is perfectly appropriate for a choice of law provision to bypass Florida's usury laws. And when the plaintiff asserts that no state in the union would uphold an agreement like that, it's just not true. There are at least five states that have no cap on interest rates. I'm struggling to remember which ones they are, but I believe it's Nevada, Utah, Indiana, Delaware, and I'm missing one off the top of my head. But the point is that the idea that this is so sacrosanct, that this is so sacred, that it can never be bypassed is simply wrong. And I would urge the court to take a look at your 2018 decision in the Veritas case, which rejects many of the arguments the plaintiffs are making now about why, in spite of those decisions, that 40-year body of law from Florida, these should be seated as the sort of sacred policy that can never be bypassed. It's just simply not true. Unless there are any other questions from the court, I'm happy to rest on our briefs.
Thank you very much to both of you. Very interesting case. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Have a great day. The court will be in recess until tomorrow morning.